From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Within the past few months, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage. Gay and lesbian couples were married in the city halls of San Francisco, New Paltz, New York, and Portland, Oregon. And President Bush registered his support of a constitutional amendment that would define marriage as a contract for heterosexual couples only. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the history of marriage and see how it may inform the debate about gay marriage. We talk with Nancy Cott, author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage in the Nation. She's a Harvard history professor. And John Witte, author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in Western Tradition. He directs the Law and Religion Program at Emory University. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon said today that 20,000 American troops scheduled to come home from Iraq will be kept there an additional 90 days to deal with increased insurgent violence. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said he regretted having to extend the tours of duty, but said the troops are doing noble work. General Peter Pace, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the military is not overextended.
We have the capacity with 2.4 million individuals available to us, active guard and reserve, to handle this ongoing war and anything that I can think of that's on the horizon.
The extended deployments mean at least 135,000 troops will remain in Iraq rather than the 115,000 the Pentagon had anticipated. Talks are underway to resolve a U.S. standoff in Najaf with radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. NPR's Philip Reeves in Baghdad says militia members in Najaf appear to be preparing for a fight.
A source in the town says that Muqtada al-Sadr's militiamen are now in the streets, that they have rocket-propelled grenades, and another report says that some of these same militiamen, a report citing an American colonel, by the way, says that these same militiamen have taken up positions on rooftops and in other strategic positions. So the city does appear to be preparing for a fight. At the same time, a senior U.S. military source has said that they believe there is still more time to negotiate in Najaf and that the issue is still very much under discussion.
NPR's Philip Reeves. European leaders have rejected the offer of a truce by a man claiming to be Osama bin Laden in a taped message, saying they would not negotiate with terrorists. Kyle James reports from Berlin.
The 7-minute message offering to end terrorist operations in Europe if nations there pull their troops out of the Muslim world has been roundly dismissed by European governments. In Berlin, a spokesperson for Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said Germany does not negotiate with criminals and terrorists. Those sentiments were largely echoed across the continent. In Britain, a spokesperson for the Foreign Office called the idea of an armistice with bin Laden an absurdity. Italy's foreign minister, whose country has been shocked by the execution of one of four Italian hostages in Iraq, said discussing a peace deal with a terrorist leader was unthinkable. Spain's incoming foreign minister suggested ignoring the message. And the president of the European Commission said the EU saw no possibility for a deal under a terrorist threat. For NPR News, I'm Kyle James in Berlin.
The State Department says it will order non-essential U.S. personnel and all family members to leave Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Colin Powell told reporters that the threat level in Saudi Arabia has gone up. In stocks, the Dow gained 19 points to close at 10,397. The Nasdaq lost 22 to 2002. This is NPR News. The Environmental Protection Agency says 31 states will have to toughen air quality enforcement because they have too much smog-producing pollution. The EPA said nearly 500 counties are violating the federal Clean Air Law. The violators are mostly in the eastern third of the country and California, and they cover an area where more than 150 million Americans live. The report says the Los Angeles Basin has the nation's worst air, and it's the only region in the country to be designated as having severe air pollution. The National Collegiate Athletic Association is proposing changes to its recruiting rules for universities. This follows allegations that the University of Colorado used the promise of alcohol and sex to recruit high school-age athletes. NPR's Jeff Brady reports from Denver.
The NCAA's proposed rules focus primarily on the perks afforded athletes and not on the behavior of recruits visiting a prospective school. That upset critics who say the organization is avoiding the problems of alcohol abuse and sexual assault. Since 1997, 8 women have come forward with allegations that Colorado football players and recruits raped them. The proposed rules say universities should not transport recruits in private planes or limousines or treat them to lavish meals or fancy hotels. But the task force said individual schools should develop their own rules to govern the behavior of athletes and recruits, and it said criminal behavior should be left to police and prosecutors. The proposed rules will undergo several reviews in coming months, with final approval expected in August. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 was up a fraction to close at 11:28. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, committed to providing an environment that supports its associates in their professional and personal lives. Our people make the difference. Information at walmartstores.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America is divided over whether gay and lesbian couples should have the right to marry. In the past few months, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage, and gay couples were married in the city halls of San Francisco, New Paltz, New York, and Portland, Oregon, until gay marriages were halted. Opponents of gay marriage are advocating a constitutional amendment, which President Bush supports, that would define marriage as an institution for heterosexual couples only. Today we're going to look at the history of marriage in America and see what clues it might offer about gay marriage and how gay marriage would affect the future of the institution. My first guest is Nancy Cott, author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. She's a professor of history at Harvard University. As a legal historian who has written about the history of marriage, do you support the legalization of gay marriage?
I think that it is the next phase of evolution of marriage in our society. Yes, I think that marriage has been developing toward an institution that is a union of two people to establish a secure household. And the parity between those two individuals has become more of a feature of the institution itself. The gender roles of the two members have become less distinguishable, the one from the other, in the past, say, 50 years. And I think equality and privacy between the partners have become the leading features of the institution, as well as the security of their commitment to each other. So that, in that sense, I think marriage between same-sex couples is following right along that line and is undoubtedly to come.
People who oppose gay marriage say it's always been about one man and one woman, and that should be unchangeable.
Within religiously understood Christian marriage, that is certainly the case. But more importantly, marriage in the United States has been authorized civilly. That is, it is a civil, secular institution in terms of its force, its authority, its legality. That is civil, not religious. The religious attributes of marriage are voluntary on the part of the couple. And the people who are most committed to the impossibility of same-sex marriage are committed in that way from a religious point of view. But their attitude, their sense of the institution is really an optional one. It's not one that's built into the law of marriage or the authority of the institution, why it has force legally. That rests with the state and has always in the United States. That is, since the colonies, in fact, but if we start with the United States itself, with the post-1776 nation, it's unquestionably true.
Let's look at some of the ways the marriage laws have changed over the years. Let's start with the early marriage laws in the United States. What did those early marriage laws say about what marriage was and what the role of the husband and the wife within marriage would be?
Looking at early marriage laws in the American colonies and then in the early states, perhaps the most important thing that need be said is much of the law of marriage was an unwritten law. It was part of the so-called common law of England, which had never been written down, so that the husband's obligation to support his wife, for instance, or the wife's obligation to obey her husband, to turn her property over to him, to work for him. In other words, her labor belonged to him. It was not hers to contract independently. Those things were not necessarily written down in a given state's laws. They needn't be to be enforced in the early United States because those understandings of marriage were part of common law. And if any case came to court, any objection were raised, it would be common law that was cited.
And when did that start to change?
It started to change in the middle of the 19th century, in part because of women's rights advocates arguing that this demise of the wife's legal individuality was unjust and unreal, didn't represent what women were really doing, and in part because of a slightly more complicated understanding by legislators of what families' interests were. The first way these laws changed was through what were called married women's property laws, which allowed a wife to keep possession of property she might have come into the marriage with, keep it in her own name, or perhaps gain property during the marriage and keep it in her own name. A major reason why such laws were passed were not what we might see today as feminist reasons, that is, to preserve the wife's individuality. It was really to preserve some portion of the family's sustenance and household goods against creditors who might be seeking to collect against the husband, so that there was a community of interest in preserving some property in the wife's name.
Why were marriage laws state laws? Why wasn't there just one federal set of marriage laws that all the states followed?
Marriage laws were seen as part of the state's police power, which is the power to protect and guard its population's health, safety, and welfare. The same reason that states have authority over local schools in the United States jurisprudence is the reason they have the authority over marriage. It's considered a domestic interest, an extension of the state's desire and obligation to protect its population in a very close sense. And the states early on were very jealous of those powers, did not want to cede those powers to the federal government. The domestic relations included not only husband and wife, they included master and servant and master and slave. And certainly in the early United States, where the slaveholding states had very different ideas about the household, who should be free in it, who should be enslaved, who should have the power over others, the states were not likely to want a uniform law when there were such diversities of opinion of how domestic relations writ large should be organized.
Gay and lesbian couples are not legally allowed to marry now, although that is certainly being challenged in several states. What are some of the other groups of people historically that were not allowed to marry during certain parts of American history?
Well, the most stunning things about marriage prohibition in American history have to do with race. And this both existed during the time of slavery in the United States and postdated it. Slaves were not able to marry legally. That was based on their condition as slaves, not literally on their race. As slaves, they did not have the power to consent. They had no civil rights because their masters had all rights over them. And the denial of legal marriage to them was one of those deprivations, one of those ways in which they had no civil rights. But quite apart from slavery, there were laws that go back as far as the 1660s and the 1680s in the Chesapeake colonies of Virginia and Maryland that made it illegal, impossible, null for a white person to marry a Negro or mulatto. Those were the terms used at the time and used all the way up through the early 20th century. These laws were designed by white legislators and upheld by white judges to preserve what they saw as racial purity. And there were laws that also prevented a white person from having a legal marriage to a Native American in a number of states, about 8 or 10 states. And then certain Western states, I think it was as many as 15 Western states at some time, had laws that made marriage between a white and a Chinese or a Japanese or another Asian of some description illegal or criminal.
Now, how long did it take until all of these laws banning interracial marriages were off the books?
It was in 1967 in a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Loving versus Virginia. Loving was, ironically, fittingly, the name of the couple who challenged the law in Virginia. In 1967, the Supreme Court, using an equal protection argument, said that these laws violated constitutional rights of Americans because marriage was a fundamental right. The right to choose one's partner was a fundamental right. And at that point, the Supreme Court said the argument from symmetry, a black cannot marry a white, true, but a white cannot marry a black. So no racial discrimination is implied here. That argument was specious because the purpose of the law clearly was to maintain white supremacy, that the law had a racially discriminatory purpose and therefore couldn't be regarded as operating symmetrically.
My guest is Nancy Kott. She's a professor of history at Harvard University and the author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nancy Kott. She's a professor of history at Harvard University and author of the book Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. And in the light of gay and lesbian couples asking for the legal right to marry, we're looking at some of the many ways that marriage laws have changed over the centuries in the United States. For people too young to remember this, can you talk a little bit about what it took to get a divorce before the no-fault divorce era?
I think many people are surprised to hear how long divorce has been possible in the United States, that this country was in the vanguard in granting divorce. Most states have had some form of divorce shortly after the American Revolution, but it was difficult to get a divorce until maybe the mid-19th century, when more grounds for divorce were mentioned. Initially, the only reason one could get a divorce was adultery or desertion if one partner simply left. But for a person to get a divorce, traditionally, the innocent party had to prove that the guilty party had committed an infraction of or and just failed to fulfill an obligation of the marriage agreement. And in certain states, and New York was prime here, in certain states, marriage, the grounds for divorce were still very minimal. New York State was one of the most conservative. And in New York, up to the 1950s, the only ground for divorce was adultery. So that couples who wanted to divorce and really had come to the conclusion that their marriage had fallen apart, both of them wanted a divorce, they were setting up, or colluding, as the verb was, colluding, framing a scene of adultery by one partner with a witness seeing it so that they could then get a lawyer, go to court, say the grounds have been met, one party was guilty, we want a divorce. And it was lawyers, really, and the American Bar Association who felt that this was a very bad scene, felt that collusion to fulfill the law, so really open flouting of the law was what it was taking to cause divorce, and that, in fact, divorce for irretrievable breakdown of a marriage ought to be possible. And it was a move from the legal community, most of all, that led toward the institution of no-fault divorce, between the mid-1960s and the early 1980s, almost all the industrialized world moved toward a no-fault divorce setup.
Now that the issue of gay marriage is coming up state by state, in addition to federal legislation and possibly a constitutional amendment, I'm wondering how states have historically honored other states' marriages and divorces.
Traditionally, there is a law regarding marriage that is not only national here in the United States, but international. It's part of international law that a marriage valid where it is celebrated is valid throughout. Now, that international law is, of course, observed where it does not conflict with the public policy of a given state authority. So that the United States, a country of immigration, has had an ambiguous position on that international law. For instance, the United States would not honor polygamous marriages in this country if polygamously married individuals came here as immigrants. Their marriages would be considered invalid as against United States public policy. And similarly between the states, states honor marriages made elsewhere unless they fly in the face of articulated public policy on the part of the states. So that this was quite operative with regard to these anti-miscegenation laws that we've discussed before. If a couple living in Virginia where they could not marry, one being white, one being black, if they went to Massachusetts and got married, they could not come back to Virginia and live again. And so there is this one accepted exception to the general state policy of giving not only full faith and credit to the state's other laws of other sorts, but giving credence to a marriage performed elsewhere in general, but not if it's against the state's articulated public policy.
The 1996 Defense of Marriage Act defined marriage as a contract between one man and one woman. It also provided that no state would be required to recognize a same-sex marriage that was performed in another state. So outside of the anti-miscegenation laws, is this the first time that there was a marriage law saying that you didn't have to honor the marriage in another state?
One thing I can say for sure is that this is the first time there's been a federal marriage law of this range and, I mean, scope. Because while the federal government has been highly involved in marriage, it's been highly involved in indirect ways through things that it does have power over, such as immigration or interstate commerce or federal income tax, citizenship laws. There hasn't been the possibility for the federal government to legislate on marriage because it has been a matter of state prerogative. That's part of federalism. So I do think that the Defense of Marriage Act is unprecedented in that regard. From another point of view, it just states as positive doctrine something that has been part of an unwritten law up till now, and that is the exception of the obligation of a state to enforce another state's law, the exception on the basis of something that flies in the face of a state's own public policy.
Now, some people advocate civil unions as an alternative to same-sex marriage. That way, the marriage laws aren't changed. And the proponents of this say that civil unions are the same as marriage, except in name. Are there certain rights that a couple who is legally bound through a civil union won't have that a couple who is bound through a marriage would have?
I think there are two important levels of distinguishing civil unions from marriages. First of all, just the legal level. So long as civil unions are granted by states, as they certainly are at present and foreseeably will be, a civil union at the state level, like the setup Vermont has, can grant all the rights, benefits, obligations, and details of marriage to a couple within the state, but can say absolutely nothing about federal rights, benefits, privileges, obligations. And those federal details of marriage are hugely extensive. There are over 1,000 places in the corpus of federal law where marriage is implicated, and these include some of the major issues like citizenship, Social Security, federal income tax, immigration, and so on. A civil union united couple has none of those prerogatives of marriage. So there's a immense legal disparity, in fact. Then there's a separate level, which is the level of more symbolic status and prestige and the attributes of civil rights that are not literal, cannot be written down. And that is that marriage has become over centuries a privileged status, a privileged self-understanding and way of being recognized in the community, so that one couple who has civil union and another who is married, they're distinct in this more impalpable and symbolic way.
You're a historian. Do you feel like history is about to be made one way or another, either in the legalization of same-sex marriage or in the official illegalization of it?
Yes, I think it's a very important point to mark in the evolution of marriage. I do think marriage has always been a changing institution, and one could point to earlier watersheds, but perhaps it's none quite so explicit as this particular turning point.
And as a historian, are you taking an activist role on this in any way?
Well, I don't consider myself an advocate. I consider myself an informed participant, and it's been great fun for me to see how important history is to this turn of events, that people are unfortunately rather ignorant about the history of marriage. I'm happy to fill them in because it's important to understand where to go in the future, to know where marriage has been in the past, particularly to understand that it isn't one thing that doesn't have a static history and all of a sudden it's being asked to change. Rather, it's been a highly evolving institution. It's one of the reasons we still have marriage and still value it. It only would be with us still if it had changed.
Well, Nancy Cott, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Nancy Cott is a professor of history at Harvard University. She's the author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. We'll hear a different point of view on how history should inform the debate on gay marriage in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. By audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. And from the Atlantic Monthly, featuring deposed New York Times editor Howell Raines on the inside events that ended his tenure, on newsstands and at theatlantic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more on the history of marriage and how it may inform the debate about gay marriage. We talk with John Woody, author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in Western Tradition. He directs the Law and Religion program at Emory University. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're hearing from two historians who have written about the history of marriage and have arrived at different conclusions about gay marriage. Earlier we heard from Nancy Cott, who thinks that gay marriage fits with the increasingly egalitarian direction that marriage has been heading in. John Witte has a different point of view. He thinks the culture isn't ready yet for gay marriage. Witte is the author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and the Law in Western Tradition, and he directs the Law and Religion program at Emory University. What are your thoughts on the legalization of gay marriage? Building on your knowledge of history and religion, do you think it's appropriate to do that now?
The answer to that question turns on where you set your historical bookends. If the relevant history that you're interested in is the last 25 years, I think a very strong case for same-sex marriage can be made out. It's the natural next step in the constitutional protection of sexual liberty and sexual privacy in this country. If the relevant history is the last 250 years or the last 2,500 years, it's much more difficult to get normative traction or sanction for same-sex marriages. The tradition of the last 250 years and certainly the last 2,500 years teaches that marriage is a heterosexual monogamous union, presumptively for life, and at the same time criminalizes acts of sodomy and buggery and other acts which are endemic to the expression of same-sex desire.
But if we discounted the last 25 years and just looked at, say, the last 250 or looked further back, then women would not have equal rights within a marriage either. And it would sure be difficult to get a divorce. So, I mean, there's so much we take for granted now in modern laws of marriage and divorce that are only, you know, dating back in concept to, say, you know, the 60s or the 70s.
That's true, although many of the changes that were made with respect, for example, to women's rights to divorce and to child custody and to marital property are actually the products of centuries-long traditions rather than the last 25 years. The notion of divorce that both men and women can enjoy was introduced for the first time in the West in the 16th century, and the American colonists were heirs to that tradition, and there were strong theological warrants for that understanding and protection of divorce for both couples. The notion of marital property has roots in the 17th century and becomes increasingly real in common law jurisdictions in the course of the 18th and early 19th centuries. And it was canonized and codified in a number of important married women property acts in the 1880s and 1890s. The relevant time window for dealing with some of these questions is not the last 25 years only. I think it's a wider compass of time and set of normative institutions that have to be considered.
A historian named John Boswell, who's written a lot about gay history, has published evidence that there really is more of a historic precedent for gay unions.
Yes, he has, and he has stimulated a veritable cottage industry of scholarship in the last 15 years since his big book on the subject. I think what that scholarship has shown is that the tradition is not univocal on issues of heterosexual monogamy being the only norm that's protected. There are liturgies, there are occasional cases, there are instances of households that are recognized and protected at law. And there are a number of examples in literature, religious and non-religious literature alike, where same-sex desire is accepted, tolerated, sometimes championed and celebrated. I think that has helped complicate the historical story, but I think it has not changed the reality that the overwhelming normative position of the Western tradition, pre- and post-Christianity, is that marriage is restricted to heterosexual monogamous union. And the attempts by some to rewrite history by anecdote or to string together a whole series of aberrations, in my view, doesn't avail much.
So are you saying that if you look at the big picture of history, and if most of history doesn't really have much precedent for legalized gay union, then that's an argument against legalizing it now? Are you saying that?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the relevant history we're talking about is the Western Christian history. I need to emphasize that because I can't speak to history beyond the Christian West. But I do think that because we are a society and a state dedicated to the rule of law, and because respect for history and precedent is an important part of what it means to be dedicated to the rule of law, history has to be relevant to the inquiry. And if we're going to go through the exercise of reconsidering a millennium-long understanding of what the marital institution is, we need to do that with trepidation, with explanation, and full ventilation of what's at stake on both sides. And the conclusion might be there are ways of reconstructing the lessons of the tradition in light of contemporary understandings of equality and liberty, and in light of contemporary appreciation for the contributions that same-sex couples and parties make to the society, that would allow us to do that reconstruction. I'm saying that history is an important part of it, and history does not, by its, unless selectively rewritten, does not condone same-sex marriage.
Now, this raises an interesting question, which is, when history and liberty, when history and freedom, or when history and civil rights come into conflict, which wins? For example, there have always been slaves historically. Is that an argument against having freed the slaves during the Civil War? Women were historically, in Western culture, subservient to men. Was that an argument against giving women the vote or giving women equal rights to men? Historically, there's been racism. Does that mean we should have kept the miscegenation laws and made it illegal for a black person and a white person to marry?
I think those are exactly the questions that have to be asked. And the question is whether our current understanding and devotion to liberty requires us to rethink what have been time-honored institutions in the West. And that was what I was trying to argue a moment ago about the necessity of reconstruction. I think we have to go through the hard exercise of thinking whether our current understandings of liberty as set forth in the Constitution and as, more importantly, culturally accepted now require us to give recognition to same-sex couples beyond the recognition already enjoyed in the civil associations and the sexual privacy and liberty norms that currently govern them.
Historically, do you think there's an argument to be made for going slow as opposed to making a larger change?
I think there is a strong historical argument if you look at the kind of cultural fallout that attached to Roe v. Wade, whose decision I actually endorse strongly. I don't think we did the important cultural homework necessary before we made a sweeping constitutional change in the Roe v. Wade decision. Domestic relations issues in general, marriage questions in particular, are state rather than federal, and they tend to be common law rather than constitutional in their principal legal pedigree. And I think what's important is in order to avoid the kind of cultural backlash that attached to the Roe v. Wade decision and its progeny, constitutional progeny by the Supreme Court, to avoid that in this case of same-sex marriage, it's in my view better to spend the time to do the hard cultural work of experimenting with gay and lesbian life, of recognizing that there are children that come from gay and lesbian households that participate in the community just as actively as their heterosexual peers, to do the kind of long reflection of our history, of our canonical texts that's necessary to think through whether what we used to understand to be the basic goods of marriage can be recalibrated to include within that same-sex marriage. And also to go through the careful sifting as to whether the arguments that are currently being deployed for same-sex marriage have a stopping point. And if they don't have a stopping point, whether we can as a community contemplate that arguments from due process and equal protection and sexual privacy can equally strongly be applied to the protection of polygamous unions, incestuous unions, and others. I'm not making an argument that if you break this one moral cord that protects heterosexual monogamy, you invariably are going to see the society unravel into a whole gaggle of sexual prurience, which some conservative critics argue. What I am saying, though, is that the kind of blunt equal protection and due process arguments that are currently being proffered don't have a natural limitation within them to preclude good faith arguments, sometimes informed by the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, for at minimum polygamous unions. And unless we're ready to contemplate that as an appropriate next step in the next generation, I think we have to be careful about rushing to precipitous constitutional change. To my mind, it's much safer to do this gradually, much safer to let the gains already made by same-sex parties, individuals and couples, to soak into the cultural soil, to become part of a community's reflexes. So it's not a superimposed constitutional change, but a change that bubbles up first from bedrooms and living rooms around the country, then from local communities, then from states. And ultimately, the Constitutional Act is an act simply of codification of what has become culturally licit, rather than the Constitution making the kind of precipitous change which the culture is not ready yet for, which is not yet ready for.
So you're arguing that we need to have cultural change, that gays need to be assimilated into the culture before we actually change the law to make gay marriage legal. But can't you argue that's already happened, that ever since the gay liberation movement started about 35 years ago, that's been happening? I mean, look at Vice President Cheney's daughter. She's a lesbian. She's out of the closet, and she was openly campaigning for him. I mean, that's probably a clue about
exactly
how gay people have been assimilated into the culture. So, I mean, you could argue, well, what else are you waiting for?
The more daughters of Dick Cheney's and the more sons of Baptist ministers and the more children of Orthodox Jewish rabbis and Muslim imams experience the reality that same-sex desire and expression and association is a natural part of life, the easier it's going to be for society to accept same-sex couples and to then accord them a series of statutory common law and eventually constitutional benefits. The danger that I see, and that's why I adduced Roe v. Wade earlier, is that to declare victory for this liberty provision prematurely is going to trigger a conservative cultural backlash that actually is going to set the movement back at law.
But look at the American Civil Rights Movement. I mean, you know, it had been, 100 years since the slaves were freed, and African Americans still didn't have equal rights. There was still legal segregation in the South. And if they had continued to wait patiently for the culture to change, if there hadn't been civil disobedience and a more confrontational movement that followed on the heels of it, who knows if we'd still have legal segregation or not.
And I think that's where those that are participating actively in same-sex marches, that are working on whittling away zoning and inheritance and other restrictions at the micro-law level, where a lot of those discriminations bite particularly hard. For those that are pressing cases in state courts rather than in federal courts, they are doing exactly what I think needs to be done to prepare the culture for acceptance and then ultimately legal recognition of same-sex coupling, which might include same-sex marriages. The danger that I see in making this a matter either of judicial decree and or 14th Amendment federal constitutional mandate is it forces this, it's a superimposition rather than a bubble-up acceptance of same-sex parties, and it's the conservative backlash to that I worry about.
My guest is John Witte. He directs the Law and Religion Program at Emory University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Witte, author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in Western Tradition. You said that if gay marriage is legalized, there needs to be some kind of stopping point, and we don't know what that stopping point is. A lot of people have suggested that if gays can legally marry, then what's next? A man marries his pussycat, a man marries three women, a man marries a pussycat and three women. I mean, is that really a serious concern that, you know, people are going to marry their pets or their farm animals?
No, I don't think that's a serious concern. I think that's a red herring in the debate. I think the more serious concern is the most natural next step after legal recognition of same-sex marriage is legal recognition of polygamous marriage. And that is an ancient battleground in the Western tradition and is a battleground in 19th century American Mormon polygamy cases that we have to be prepared to join in the event that we make this next step. I think what we might be moving toward, frankly, in the next generation or two, is a set of states that offer a series of off-the-rack models of what intimate association entails. Those could include heterosexual monogamous union. Those could include homosexual monogamous union. Those could include religiously grounded polygamous union. Those could include an opt-out, which is what current covenant marriage statutes in the three states that have covenant marriage statutes allow. But three states, Louisiana, Arizona, and Arkansas, currently have two options for Jack and Jill who march up to the marriage registry. One is civil marriage, which is the traditional easy-in, easy-out marriage available in all 49 other states. And the other option is covenant marriage, which gives parties firmer formation requirements and harder exit rules. It's harder to get in, harder to get out of a covenant marriage as opposed to a contract or civil marriage. If you think about that, that might well provide a stepping stone toward a more ambitious set of opt-out provisions, which would say to parties, you can opt out of the marriage institutions that the state makes available to you altogether if you have a bona fide religious community of which you're a part. You can simply take the marriage and domestic relations laws of your local Orthodox Jewish community or your Muslim community or your Mormon community or your Catholic community and choose to abide by them and leave it to them to set the rules and procedures for marital formation and dissolution. That might sound fantastical, but that's exactly what is available currently in South Africa under its recent constitution. That's been available in India for the last 65 years, and it's something which countries that have had experience with the common law of marriage have now begun to contemplate as a way of dealing with the cultural, religious, and moral pluralism that gets attached to issues of domestic relations.
Well, in a way, isn't that already happening? I mean,
yes.
What's happening in the United States is a lot of gay couples are getting married in their church or in their synagogue. The problem is that it's not recognized outside of their religion. The state doesn't recognize it. The federal government doesn't recognize it.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
So you're arguing that what you're suggesting is that if you get married within the religion, if it's good enough for the religion, that the state and the Fed respect it, recognize it.
I'm not sure I'm arguing that. I am arguing that that could be a step along the way to the eventual, among other steps, the eventual recognition of several off-the-rack models that the state would hold out, including one where parties can simply opt into any number of different religious communities' domestic relations systems.
Now, again, you say that there needs to be a stopping point so that, you know, polygamy isn't legalized if we legalize gay marriage. I guess I don't understand why if two women or two men get married, how does that bring us any closer to three people or seven people getting married? I don't really understand why that brings us closer to polygamy. Yeah.
Let me rephrase the question a little bit, if I may. I didn't say we need to find a stopping point. I think we have to contemplate that the current equal protection, sexual liberty, sexual privacy, due process arguments that are being used to advance the cause for the liberty of same-sex couples to marry are equally cogent with respect to a group of polygamous parties to come together into a marriage, three or more parties. And if you add to that the reality that some of the ardent supporters for bigamy or polygamous marriage are doing so on the strength of religious convictions that are protected by the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause and comparable provisions in state constitutions, it gets even harder to resist that next step. And all my caution is that if we accept the conclusion compelled by the logic of equal protection and sexual liberty and privacy to accord marital status to same-sex couples, we are going to have to be ready also to accept the easy next step, which is not the fantastical step of marrying a cat or you know, marrying your tractor or something like that, but a realistic next step, which in point of fact is de facto existing in this country with impunity in some states. We're ready to make that step, we should make that step. If we're not ready to make that step, let's give some pause to the arguments about same-sex marriage and think if there are more creative ways of building in stopping points to that logic. We are dealing with constitutional questions with respect to intimate associations. When you create a precedent that the Equal Protection Clause and privacy interests of same-sex couples need to be protected, there's no easy stopping point in that logic to preclude a good faith Jack, Jill, and Jennifer trio to march into court. We believe in stare decisis. We believe in holding to precedents and treating comparable cases alike. And this could well be postulated as a comparable case. And it's not that gays are taking the rap. It's that we are dealing with difficult questions of constitutional precedent, whose application in subsequent cases always has to be considered before you're going to make a momentous decision.
So what you're saying is, if the law is rewritten so that marriage is no longer a contract between one man and one woman, then it opens up the door to other changes. But what if it was changed to, you know, marriage is a contract between one person and another person? There's still the one and one in there.
There's still the one and the one in there, and it's difficult for that line drawing of marriage is only two parties to withstand the strict scrutiny that a court might apply on the basis of equal protection precedents. Why does Jack, Jill, and Jennifer not get the same shake that Jack and Jennifer or Jack and John get?
My guest is John Witte. He directs the Law and Religion Program at Emory University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Witte, author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in Western Tradition. We're talking about how history may inform the debate about gay marriage. On one side, we have gay couples who want to get married and who are pressing for that legal right. On the other side, you have the people who want a constitutional amendment that would define marriage as a contract between one man and one woman, thus totally outlawing the possibility of gay marriage. Our president has said he would endorse that he does favor that. What would it mean legally to add a constitutional amendment that restricts that right of marriage?
First of all, let me say I find that to be a very unfortunate form of constitutional brinksmanship. Marriage and domestic relations issues are principally state issues, not federal issues. They're principally statutory and common law issues, not constitutional issues. And for us to contemplate in the country a federal constitutional amendment that would define an institution this way, I think is a very dangerous precedent, and I hope it doesn't pass. The legal consequence of having such an amendment pass would be that courts, federal and eventually state, would have constitutional warrant to begin to insist upon the letter of that constitution and then to think creatively about what the letter of that constitutional amendment would mean for all manner of things at the state and the local level.
It seems to me there's two ways, at least two ways, to deploy history in examining the issue of gay marriage. One is to say the history of marriage is a history of change. It's a history of changing divorce laws, changing, you know, miscegenation laws, changing laws about a woman's rights within the marriage. It's just constantly changed, and that's what's kept the institution alive. The other way of looking at it is to say, well, we don't have a lot of historic precedent of this, therefore we should either not do it or really take it very, very slowly. Is that fair to say that is there's those two divergent ways of looking at history?
That is fair to say it that way, but what's common is that there's presupposed in both of those scenarios is the understanding that the definition of marriage is not up for grabs. Marriage is a heterosexual monogamous union, subject to all manner of change with respect to its formation, its maintenance, its dissolution, the associations that are listed alongside it. But the assumption in both of those scenarios is that marriage has a common form. The change that we're contemplating now is a much more momentous change. We are contemplating changing the players in the institution of marriage. And while we do have engines of change within the tradition that can well be catalyzed, it's very important to recognize that the change we're contemplating now is a much more momentous one. And if it's going to be made, it needs to be made with full ventilation, full understanding of what the issues are on all sides, and full recognition that the precedent we're laying here has cultural implications that need to be thought through. That's not to say that history precludes this kind of change. It is to say, however, that if we're going to make the change, let's do it with full democratic caution and discernment and ventilation.
John Woody, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
John Woody is the author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in Western Tradition. He directs the Law and Religion program at Emory University. Earlier, we heard from historian Nancy Cott, who thinks that gay marriage fits into the increasingly egalitarian direction marriage has been heading in. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by BBC America, presenting The Office, the innovative British comedy about the banality of 9-to-5 in excruciating detail, Thursday nights at 10 on BBC America, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Whisker of Evil, a Mrs. Murphy mystery by Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown, authors of The Tale of the Tip-Off. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Am I awake?
On the next Fresh Air, they might be giants. John Linnell and John Flansburg have been making music together for over 20 years. They just released a new EP. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
When I get through this day, can someone tell